Om Shanti. Everyone okay? Om Shanti. If there's one aspect of Baba's Gyan that appeals to me, and it's always appealed to me, it's the aspect of being unlimited, going beyond all limits. I'm sure the idea must attract everyone here, going beyond bondages, going beyond useless thinking, going beyond being petty, you know, little-hearted, little-minded, and thereby recuperating our greatness. Does it attract you also, being unlimited? Yeah? Every day we hear Baba say the word at least once, and sometimes many times. The unlimited Father speaks to the unlimited children about becoming unlimited. And it's the real appeal of God, isn't it? The fact that He is absolutely, totally, 100% unlimited, and therefore completely impartial, completely detached and able to love. Seeing everything clearly and not partially. And this is the same requirement for us, that we can reach such a stage. This afternoon I was looking at different mullis and Baba's messages and one or two daddy's classes about this topic. And it seemed that Baba was talking always about five things related to the word unlimited. First of all, we have unlimited disinterest. And then Baba talks about the unlimited attitude. Baba also talks about unlimited vision, unlimited stage, unlimited service. So disinterest, attitude, vision, stage, service. Sometimes he mentions unlimited actions, but you could probably relate that to service as well. Unlimited thinking, unlimited... I don't think we could talk about unlimited speaking, could we? I mean, unlimited speaking is called waffling on. Going on and going on. But certainly the actions that we do have having an unlimited impact rather than just a localized one. And so I'd like to share some thoughts on these different states of being unlimited, and perhaps later on we can go through them again and stop and experience each one. When we talk about unlimited disinterest, it doesn't really mean that you become indifferent to everything. Unlimited indifference, it's not the same thing. It just really means that you've identified what is completely useful in your efforts to become an angel, to become like God? And what's not useful? What sort of thoughts, words and actions, activities, interests can really help us to progress spiritually and go beyond the ropes that tie us down, break those ropes, and start to have an impact on the whole world, actually on the whole universe. Recently, we developed a course on overcoming anger and resolving conflicts in Brazil, and to try out the material that we'd gathered together, we decided to have a retreat, and it was completely booked out within 3 or 4 days. In our retreat place, we've only got 60 beds, so only 60 people can come. And there were 100 people who signed up for it. So we decided to do a second one as well. And again, another 100 signed up. So seems like a very popular topic. And in the first group, there were around, I would say, half and half BKs and contact people, interested parties, because I think everyone would like to understand a little bit about how to overcome anger. Is that right? Baba's been talking about the children of anger. And so I made a questionnaire. And each question was related to one aspect of anger's children, like indignation, impatience, intolerance, you know, tension. It's also a form of anger, by the way. And they were very simple questions, very simple situations, you know. Are you more impatient than you'd like to be? Yes or no? What do you think? Yes or no? Do you get tense when there's an important task in front of you? Yes or no? If you see someone with whom you've had a conflict of interests, a clash of sanskars, in other words, you see that person coming towards you, do you move the other way? If you know that someone is talking not nice things about you, do you freeze the communication with that person? Yes or no? You know, freeze the communication, like, at least temporarily, you know that person's doing something really not so good. Do you freeze the communication? Yes or no? And so everyone was going through these things. And to my not so much surprise, the BKs and the people who were not BKs had more or less the same marks. And it was a big realization, you know. What is the sort of attention that we're giving to our efforts? Or do we think that, you know, everything is okay? And from that supercilious, means looking from the eyebrows downwards, you think that you are better than others? No. In fact, the ones who got zero in that questionnaire, and it was a little bit of a game, by the way, I said the ones that get zero are angels. If you get 5, then you're pretty spiritual. If you get 10 yeses, means 10 situations in which you didn't pass, then you're probably aware that you're not so spiritual as you'd like to be. If you get 15, you're probably feeling pretty sorry for yourself. So if you get 20 yeses out of 20, you probably don't have any friends. Just to make it light. But the object of the exercise was to see. But to show people that the type of effort you need to go beyond are in the little things. In the little situations, right? So what are the activities, feelings, objectives, interests, and situations that hold us up? And what are the ones that help us move forward? How can I jump over these little tests rather than being stopped by them? And this is where the depth of unlimitedness probably comes in. Because if you are truly unlimited, then how can, you know, something like that just stop you? And they do stop us, right? A little thing here, a little thing there, something late, something not done properly. I remember, which is for me the epitome of, I would say, being so task conscious that you forget what you're doing, what you're really supposed to be doing. You know, most of our programs, we have blessings, right? We call them blessings. They're just some nice, beautiful spiritual messages that are nicely printed or even handwritten on cards or on leaves or on flowers maybe. And it's such a beautiful token. It's become a trademark that if there's any program, especially like a retreat or something, then everyone gets a tolly or several tollies, right? And maybe one or two blessings. I asked Charlie this afternoon, because we just received a blessing card from Daddy Janky. I said, "Charlie, how many blessings have you received over the years?" He said, "About two boxes full." And he said he collects them. He's going to, next tour that he does, he's going to take a box of the blessings with him. And they're all different. Wouldn't that be nice? Blessings. Anyway, I was in a place, I'm not going to mention the name. There was a retreat on. Everything was organized, but the person that was supposed to bring the blessings had forgotten them. Left them on the table. And so the tollies are there, and the person in charge of the whole organization, "Where are the blessings?" And the person who'd forgotten is admitted, "I forgot." And the person organizing said, "What? What do you mean? Where are the blessings?" And the person who'd forgotten said, "Where are your blessings?" So where are the blessings? What is a blessing? Is it a piece of paper? Obviously not. So it means if we are task conscious or task oriented, we'll always forget the bigger objective. And therefore let's say, what is it that makes my spirituality work, and what is it that holds it up? I have to identify if I want to go beyond, which means become unlimited. If I want to go beyond limitations, I have to understand what are the thoughts, feelings, words, activities that are useful for me and which are not. Yeah. And in fact, the unlimited attitude is an attitude on one side of disinterest. That means not really disinterest, but of non-interest in the things that are useless. And real interest in the things that are. And that makes me very, two things. It makes me available. So an unlimited attitude is an attitude of availability. And it's an attitude of being able to adjust immediately to circumstances because you are free. If you are free in your thinking, there's nothing in the past weighing there. There's nothing in the future making you afraid or apprehensive. You're free just to enjoy and to perceive the present that's going on and just, you know, adjust. And this is where the big test is. It's in the ability to make immediate adjustments to circumstances that are 99.9999% of the time beyond our control. We do not dictate to the drama. Today I want this drama to happen. Today I want such and such a situation to happen. You see, the things are so too complex. We have to say to the drama, oh, wonderful, you are happening. It's not exactly how I planned, but... And if we remember that it is a play in which we're just actors, that's the attitude of unlimited preparedness, perhaps. Attitude is like an internal posture. It's a posture that you adopt in the face of circumstances. And I mean, let's say physically you're in the middle of the road and a car is coming and you didn't see it, then you have to make a quick jump to the side, otherwise you'll get splattered. Is that right? In a similar way, the soul has to make a quick move in the face of circumstances so as not to get splattered by them. You know, not to get crushed or battered or broken by a situation. So someone with an unlimited attitude will never question, where are the blessings, you know? Or where is this, or why is this, or what happened, who, when, looking for the fault makers, but will be adjusting to the new circumstance. In this case, for example, oh, the blessings didn't come, okay. Maybe we can do something quickly now and make sure that the next time things are better organized. But what can you do if the blessings are sitting on a table 100 kilometers away? You can't do anything. So let's use some flowers and some leaves. Let's do something different, maybe. Let's do a verbal thing. These are the adjustments that someone with an unlimited attitude would be able to make immediately in the face of the circumstance. So the limited attitude would be why, who, when, where, what, how, right? And if you look carefully at the Moolis, when Baba talks about limited thinking, he's always talking about questions. The ability to put a full stop on a situation is someone who is absolutely free to make that judgment, to make that call immediately. Okay. I remember I was sitting in a meeting with Daddy Jenki here, and one very very good and experienced brother from the UK had a heart attack in Pandavabhavan in the bathroom. So someone who'd worked with Daddy for years, 20 years. And I can sort of understand maybe 50% of the Hindi that I listen to. I can't really reproduce it, but I can understand more or less the flow of things. And it was incredible to see her immediate total adjustment to the fact that someone who'd been working with her for years and years and years had left the body in a heart attack in Pandavabhavan, just up the road. And she was completely the same before, during, and after the news. So to get to that state where something quite drastic or something quite difficult or something quite important that happens and you're able to make an adjustment immediately to the extent, because you know deeply, not only know, you're absolutely convinced, it's in your veins, that you cannot change any circumstance that has already happened. So why question it? You prepare for the future because you can't change anything that happened even a second ago. Next time, next time, next time. And now, what's the solution? So the unlimited attitude is the attitude of a solution finder rather than a problem identifier. Yeah. What to do is the attitude of unlimitedness. What to do now? Okay, happened, fine. Now, what? And that's, if we don't have that, then our marks will be the same as anyone else's. Even in spite of having knowledge. Because when we talk about it and when we share it amongst ourselves, it is definitely not the same thing as practicing it in the moments of truth where our knowledge and understanding are being tested, which happens how many times a day? How many times a day was your understanding tested? Did it happen today? Huh? Were you tested today? Did you have a test? Yeah? Hands up those who've had a test today. And the others? Just cruising along, is it? Just... To imagine that you're okay is not the same as being okay. Yeah. We're all nice with nice people. We have to be nice with the ones that are not so nice. Then we could say, yes, we are nice people. Yeah. I was the other day in South Africa and I asked how many in the audience were perfectionists. Any perfectionists here? Do you have a hard time with that? Do you create a hard time for other people? And I said to the people, they became shocked. I said, a perfectionist has a lot in common with a murderer. And they, why? What? How? So I told the story that many years ago when I was still in Australia, we'd started the centre in Melbourne and I'd gone there to help Charlie. Actually, Charlie came back from London. I was already in Sydney starting the centre there. And Charlie came back from London And we loaded up the car. He stayed for a few months in Sydney. We loaded up a car full of stuff and we drove down the highway about 1,000 kilometres away. And we started a centre in Melbourne. And it was pretty nice. One thing led to the other. And even a few months after that we started the centre, I went and spent a year there. And during 6 months, I had the chance to go to a prison of maximum security prison, where all of the inmates were murderers or rapists or, you know, bank robbers. People that were in there for more than, say, 20 years. Some of them had a life sentence. And the idea was to teach meditation to them. It was interesting because what was the angle that you're going to take with such extreme people, right? Because they were, you know, very uptight, very tense, very rebellious because they're imprisoned. And they look in front of them, there's just maybe another 10 years to go, another 15 years to go, another 20 years to go before they can even think about getting out, you know. So the first few sessions were just, you know, pretty terrible because the group was just swearing at me, you know, and very gruff and grumbly and like a bunch of, you know, angry dogs, literally. And I started to say, okay, you know, I'm committed to help you people. Would you like to be free? At least mentally. Because no one can imprison your minds. You know, you're here in a physical prison, but you can be freer mentally than even the people outside. Because people move around in their own portable prisons. You know, people are behind their own bars of their own thinking and their own circumstances and their own body even. You know, the body's not working. And gradually a group formed, you know, with these sort of arguments. A group formed. And there were about 20, I suppose, in the group after all. From about 50 it came down to 20. And I would go there every week and it was really a great experience for me and for them. So I gave them even some pictures of Baba and, you know, Shiv Baba and the tree. I remember we had a beautiful poster of the tree made then. So they all had the tree and Shiv Baba in their cells. But the leader of the group was a murderer. In an afternoon of madness, he'd killed his mother, father, wife and kids. Of course, you can't condone that sort of behavior, yeah? But I asked him, why did you do it? He said, well, I'd been out of work for 6 months. And everyone was telling me that I'm lazy, no good, good for nothing, useless. At least 50 times a day, I'm hearing this from all sides. So one afternoon I just exploded and shot everyone. And before I was going to shoot myself, they stopped me. But why did you do it? He said, well, I wanted a bit of peace. I wanted some peace of mind. Can you imagine? The motive, the deep motive, is the same motive as anyone, isn't it? The way that we express it may not be the best. It may be even extreme as a murderer. But that's why a perfectionist has a lot in common with a murderer, or any extreme attitude, actually. What we really want is what we want to get free from our own thinking, perhaps. And the way we want to have things okay. We want things to be okay somehow. And the way we do it can be like an angel and it can be like a murderer. So I'm not saying that we should condone this sort of behavior. But I'm just saying that the deep motives of everyone, it's a soul trying to be free. The soul trying to be free from himself. Have you felt fed up recently with anything? Be honest. Has anyone or anything made you feel fed up? Or up to here? No? Maybe up to here. Up to here? Up to here! Wow! I know that in different languages it's a different expression, but in English, fed up means that you've eaten too much, right? So who feeds you if you're fed up? Who feeds you if you're fed up? Huh? But who's Maya? Say it. Me. Me when I am limited. That's what Maya is. Maya is not something else. Even though Baba personifies it, sometimes says it's the cat or the alligator or the rat that blows and then bites and so on. But in fact, it's our own limited thinking, right? Right? Limited thinking, you know what that is? What's going on? Who am I? What, you know, oh, my body's sore, it's aching, oh, not enough time. I can't do it, you know. Or I want something, you want desire for recognition, desire for some sort of reward. If you check deeply, if you ever suffer from anyone, it's because you want something from them and you're not getting it. Or you get something different from what you want. So if you desire something from anyone, you've bound yourself to that person. You are locked to that person. And you know, if you're locked to somebody, they're a different wheel to you. You're a round one, they're a square one. And so moving along with someone to whom you are locked is a rocky journey. Yeah? So, there's a story about a poor miser. Generally, stories about misers are about rich ones. This one's a miser for a grain of rice, greedy for a little thing. And of course, he lived all the time without anything. His cupboards were bare. He was always hungry. And at the same time, anything that fell his way, he was very, very miserly about it. So one day he's going home wondering what he's going to eat. And he finds a big bag of rice that's probably fallen off a cart somewhere. And before he became so miserly, he had been a cook, a very good one. So he took the rice home. And the only thing he had in the cupboard, in fact, were spices. So he made a very nice pot of rice, a big pot of rice. And he put it on the table in front of him. And he started to think, I'm going to sell this rice. I'm going to make a lot of money. Everyone will like it. They will buy it. They will pay the price I'm going to ask for it. And when I've sold it all, I'm going to buy a goat. And that goat will give so much milk. I will sell the milk and buy another goat. And then I'll make that goat make so much milk, I buy a third goat. When I have five goats, I'll buy a cow. I'll sell the goats and buy a cow. And the cow will give so much milk that I'll buy another cow, and then another one, and then another one. I'll have five cows. When I've got five cows, I'll sell them and buy a horse. And then I'll start to breed horses. because horses in our region are very valuable. And when I've got a band of horses, I'll sell them and I'll have enough money to ask the hand of the rich girl in the next village in marriage. And I will marry her. And we will have two kids, one girl and one boy. And when they grow up, right, they'll be much closer to me than to my wife. Because if that woman dares to interfere with my relationship, with my kids, I'm going to kick her. So what happened to the rice? The rice fell on the floor. The pot broke. He couldn't sell it anymore. So, it's an extreme story, isn't it, of fantasizing. But sometimes we get caught up in that sort of thing. When this happens, or when that happens, or when I have this, and when this goes, and when this works, and when I go to Madaban, this time when I go to Madaban, I'll really get my stage together. And when I get back, I would do this and I would do that, and then I'll be able to do this and buy that, and then. Oops! So the pin pricked the bubble, right? So if you want to be unlimited, I think if we want to be unlimited, we have to be real. Do a reality check. You know, there are three sides to a conflict. Three sides. There are both sides and the truth. Because neither one in a conflict will see it. And we have to, if we want to be unlimited, stick with the facts. Stick with the reality and go beyond opinions and interpretations of it. And then we have the unlimited vision. The unlimited disinterest prepares us to have an unlimited attitude. An unlimited attitude prepares us to have an unlimited vision. So how far can we see? That's the test of our vision. If you can only see the walls around you, whether they be physical walls or mental walls or relationship walls or task walls or activity walls or place walls, body walls, they're still walls, yeah? So if you look around, you see walls, how far can you see? That's the question. So the question for the unlimited disinterest is, what's useful? The question for the unlimited attitude is, how immediate can I adjust myself to circumstances? And the question for the unlimited vision is, how far can I really see? Yeah? So if my vision is on eternal and real things, they last forever, so my vision spreads out. If they're on defects, on problems, on difficulties, on expectations and rewards and recognition, then that's as far as I can see. And of course, if we limit our vision from outside of ourself, it's because we see ourselves as being limited. I'm only limited, therefore I can only see so far. And of course, what to do? A lady came to me and after a program and said, you know, my husband, you know, I don't know what's happening with him. He's got such bad attitudes and bad behavior. I really think he's going to the dogs, going to going to hell with his attitude. Something's going to happen, you know. I'm really worried about him. So I asked her, what sort of a husband would you like to have? She said, oh, I have never thought about that. So if you don't know what sort of a husband you'd like to have, how can you be example for him? Oh, I haven't thought about that either. And I asked her, does he have any virtues by any chance? She said, wait a minute, I've been married to him for 30 years, let me think, you know. And she had to stop and think, you know, virtues. It took about 5 minutes for her to think of one virtue. So it became obvious that for the last several years at least, she had not thought of one virtue in him at all, never. Can you imagine the relationship, you know? And I said to her, look, let's imagine that you don't know about your husband, that on the side he's going to the meditation center. And let's imagine that he's trying to make some sort of an effort to get out of the hell that you say he's creating. You know, he's doing something, he's making some effort. Does your attitude and your vision help him? And she said, I don't think so. If you started to see his virtues, would you be helping him? Yes, I think so. So I said to her, gave her an image to think about. Imagine that he's in a coffin, right? Sort of laid out. You know, he's reached a sort of a spiritual death because of such bad and angry and terrible attitudes and behaviors. And let's say that he's got a spark of life back in him and he's struggling to get up out of the coffin. And you know something? You're sitting on the lid. Translation. The translation delay, right? Actually, the delayed laughter is even funnier than the first one, right? You see? So don't sit on people's lids. How does Baba see us? That's the vision that we have to train ourselves to have. Right? Baba sees the whole picture. Past, present, future. Past, original past, right? He sees the fact that we've lost our power through a very long process. He sees where we've arrived. But he knows that if he invests his vision in the things that will bring us back to what we were, that's the best use of his time. And it works every cycle, whether we understand it or not, whether we like it or not. It works every time. Never fail to work God's vision on us. So why do we insist on our vision of things and people when we know that an unlimited vision is the only one that really works in the long term? We know it, right? Do you know it? So these are the challenges that we have, you know. And if we're able to get a vision that sees far and that includes and doesn't exclude anyone, that really doesn't differentiate between perfectionists and murderers, that's the unlimited vision, that doesn't see, temporary states confusing the real and eternal state. And that's, we have to go beyond seeing the temporary things and giving them an importance more than they really have, to seeing the whole picture and where things really fit. That's the unlimited vision. And it's like, you know, this is really these three things, the unlimited disinterest, the unlimited attitude, and the unlimited vision, are the basis of the unlimited stage, which is the fourth thing that we were talking about. The unlimited stage, like the word has two meanings in English, at least, where you sit and your state of mind. So it's not just where you sit, it's how you sit spiritually, which is your stage. Where you are and how you are spiritually is your stage, therefore. And we know that the biggest ingredient to have a good stage is to be fed from one side, using knowledge, using experience, using situations to put our understanding into practice. But the other side, definitely, there are two fields in which we can use two fields to bring us into an unlimited state of consciousness, which is relationships with God and the field of service, unlimited service. So how ready am I, you know? To serve in an unlimited and non-exclusive way, a way that does not exclude, a way that sees rich and poor alike. We just see souls that need help, yeah? A way that's sort of sensitive to people's needs. It's a stage that, let's say, that Baba sometimes asks us about, if we're really able to hear the cries of the people that are suffering in our meditations. Can we hear them, or we're so much caught up in our own noise that we can't hear the cries of the sufferers? You know, when I was putting this material together for the Overcoming Anger course, I became aware of something that, of course, I'd known, but really hadn't clicked for me. The fact that people, almost 100% of all people, believe that anger is not something you can overcome. It's only something you can manage. It's natural. So, the social consequences of an angry person are, you know, so recognizable that people try to control it, you know. But to imagine that they would be able to, at some point, overcome the anger, not just learn to manage it. You know, there are lots of anger management courses around, yeah. But to overcome it, people have never even heard of or thought about that possibility. So, in fact, people are forced to have only two possibilities. They get angry or they get sick. You know, they let it out through active or passive ways, you know, sulking, slamming doors, shouting, even physical violence. Or they swallow it in and try to sort of simmer internally, and they get sick. So you see a person with a red face screaming and another person with a migraine headache, and you're just seeing the same person, actually. Someone who let it out and someone who made himself sick. And people really only have those two alternatives, because they would never imagine that it's possible to sublimate, to transform those thoughts and feelings. So when I started to think about this, my God, You know, how sad. People are suffering so much because of their own ignorance. And so we hear, do we hear the suffering? Or do we hear our own suffering more? Do we hear what people need, or do we think about our own needs more? You know, my foot is hurting, my this and that, and my time, you know, I can't, this reason, my husband, so on and so forth. I think it was Neville who was mentioning to me the other day that, no, Charlie, he was visiting Cambridge, and he asked Dr. Prashant if Stephen Hawking, you know, the physicist or mathematician, brilliant Nobel physics or something, has such a deep understanding of time and space and whatever. He's the only two things that work in his body are the brain and one finger. Right? And Charlie was saying to Prashant, does he still live in Cambridge? And they turned the corner and there he was in his wheelchair. You know, he communicates to the world through a computerized voice. You've heard about him, right? Stephen Hawking. Imagine, the only thing, the only two things that work are a finger and a brain. One finger. Imagine if you only had one finger. What could you do? At least you could point to God, maybe. But it's an incredible story of someone who, in spite of such severe limitations, was able to have an impact on human society. Yeah? I met a guy who became blind when he was 15, and he had a PhD in education. He was blind. So he wasn't blind from birth, but he became blind at around about the age when you're thinking about what to do about your future. And he had a PhD in education, and he was head of a government department to look after handicapped people. So we should not allow our limitations to stop us from doing what we're supposed to be doing, when there are so many examples of people doing smaller things, maybe specific things, who've been able to overcome very severe limitations. And we worry that Baba says, you know, don't become so dependent on your facilities. The car doesn't work, so I won't go to the class today. Yeah. In some cities of the world, every day, two number plates can't go on the road at the peak hours to keep the traffic down. And it's funny, on those days, those Brahmins don't make the effort to go to class. Their car doesn't work, you know. Or something is not there, or something is not available, or it's not the right time. You know, what would stop us except our own thinking? So the question about the stage is, how close am I in my relationship with Baba? And the question about service is, how ready am I? So let's do a bit of reflection on that. So put your pads down. Can we change the lights, please? So for the next 5 minutes, put yourself in the center of your life. Have a look around you. what are the things that are part of my life which are really useful? And in that, how useful have I made them? There can be some useful things, but I haven't extracted their real use yet. And how many attitudes, activities, maybe interests, hobbies, pastimes or whatever, in no way can I extract usefulness out of them. So let me leave them aside. That's the understanding of unlimited disinterest. What's useful, really, for me to, for my own spiritual progress, and for the service that is possible through me. And if I see what's really useful, automatically I'll see and understand what's not. So see yourself in the center of your life. Aware of your own true and real potential. And looking at things that I can use as a springboard to higher states. Don't see the responsibilities as dead weights. That are tying you down, but how to make that responsibility really useful for my own spiritual progress and the service that is possible through me. Next question. About my attitudes. How free am I to make immediate adjustments? The circumstances. How available am I to do the best? How much has my understanding made me flexible? Without breaking. How much do I understand that there's never a moment when my understanding will not be tested? How much have I made the knowledge into understanding? That I can truly put a full stop. And not question something that's happened. How free am I of judgment and prejudice? That I can truly accept anyone and anything as being real and true in their own right. Next question. How far can I see? Can I see the brilliant future? Can I see my future form? Can I see beyond obstacles? Can I see my own perfection? Sustain that throne of deep self-respect and look at the people and things around you. Can I see through people to their very core of goodness? Or does my vision stop at their surface defects? I see behind the scenes the real meaning of them, or does my vision stop? At the details. So continue sitting on your throne of self-respect and ask yourself, how much light do I produce? How light am I? sit yourself in front of Baba. And try to be like that for some moments. What really interests Baba? Is that my interest? Think of Baba's posture towards the world. Is that my posture? Think of how Baba sees everyone, including ourselves. Do I see myself as Baba sees me? Do I see others as Baba sees them? Do I see the divine task of transformation as Baba sees it? Do I see the same future that Baba sees? So in a very loveful way, let's do this checking. Am I limited to a place, to a group of people? To some possessions? Do I have a sense of mastery? Because I have nothing, I have the whole world in front of me. So let's just hold the globe on our hearts. And together with Baba, let's serve it with the very best in us, in silence.